This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to Calmversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's Calmversant is Mary Harrington, who is a British-based author of articles, not yet books, but she's planning on 10. It's a wonderful conversation. I don't even know how to encapsulate it. We are of a very similar mind about the ways in which postmodernism as a form of interaction with different means of meaning making is actually a necessary step to being somebody who can craft meaning authentically and creatively in the current environment. Now, a lot of people hate postmodernism, but we distinguish basically, there's the creative postmodernism and then the purely nihilistic postmodernism. We kind of get into that, but we also get into like 10 other topics. This is the beginning of 10 other episodes of conversation with Mary Harrington. She's a fabulous author. I love her brain and I love her ideas. And those are linked down in the description. I don't want to butcher the prelude with any more of my babbling. So I'm going to get out of the way and introduce you to Mary Harrington. Are you a full-time writer? Is that your
I don't know. I suppose I kind of am now. Although I wasn't really, I mean, it's something, it's what I always wanted to do, but I never really expected to find myself actually doing it because I did pretty much anything but that for about 20 years. I've been like a janitor and a stay at home mom, and I hated marketing, but did that for about 10 years and all kinds of stuff. Okay. Yeah. It's, I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I ended up just thinking, by the time I sort of fell off the end of the work pipeline having a baby because I was working a contract at the time, and it just didn't really feel ethical to sign up for another one without telling them I was pregnant. Mm. That just felt rude. So then I just kind of didn't go back to work for a bit. And that was, then I thought, well, that's it. I'm probably just unemployable now. Oh, and yeah. the reason I started writing was because I got really bored. And I have this friend who's kind of, she's sort of third generation art world. And she and I both had kids at the same time. And we took to WhatsApping each other our kids, like toddler scribbles, with this very serious commentary in the style of a contemporary art gallery. Which It really works. If you look at it, you just look at these scribbles slightly differently. You're like, yeah, you know, it's sort of Jackson Pollock. And so I started blogging it, and it just went a bit viral. I can't remember when it was, 2 or 3 years ago, one summer. And a friend happened to see it, who actually is an art gallery, who does run an art gallery, and was like, oh, Mary, you should write. You should do more writing because your writing's really funny. And so I thought, okay. It was completely by coincidence. I ran into her at a friend's party, and she was like, oh, you should do some writing. And I thought, well, it's what I always wanted to do. And so I just pitched a couple of things, and literally I pitched two articles to sort of free, like, political websites. And after that, Unheard wrote to me to say, Mary, would you like to pitch to us? And I did.
Oh, okay.
And I think I've written an article for them pretty much every week since, and it really just wasn't planned at all.
So when did you start working with Unheard? When did you start this writing thing then? Like what year?
That was November. I think the first thing I did for them was maybe September-ish 2019.
Okay, yeah.
So really not very long ago.
And it's mostly politics, you would say?
It's all sorts of weird.
Yeah, it's
stuff.
All sorts of things. I really like it. It's a really great grab bag of just your
all sorts
your
of weird stuff.
Thoughts.
Yeah, so, well, I do a lot of long-distance running, and just things kind of filter their way to the surface when I'm out running.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I never really know what's going to surface next. I think the first one I did was I was attacking the idea of growth from the right, which I just thought was like, it was just a fun thing to try and do.
What do you mean, attacking the idea?
I thought it would be fun to have a go at the Conservative Party from the right and blame everything that was wrong with them on the fact that they're obsessed with growth. You know, the way the left has all of these sort of sacred ideas, these sort of these areas where you must not go, and there are certain, and there are, mm. there are that's just the way it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, people on the right are very fond of saying, well, you know, we're not like that. We just kind of, you know, we have our, you know, we accept facts and evidence, and, you know, we're not ideological about anything. And I, yeah, bollocks.
Yeah,
right. Right. And I just wanted to argue the case that economic growth has become for the right exactly the same sort of sacred cow.
Okay.
As certain, you know, certain identity categories and sort of rules about what you can say around identity are for the left. And that basically pretty much everything that conservatives used to believe have been sacrificed to the great god growth. And you can make the case. You can completely make the case.
Yeah.
I mean, family has been sacrificed to growth. Pretty much national belonging has been sacrificed to growth. You know, any sort of conservation of the environment has been sacrificed to growth. You know, the list goes on. You can think of pretty much everything that conservatives used to believe goes completely down the can when it's like, oh yeah, but that might hurt the economy. And out it goes. And as a result, you know, a lot of the people who used to think of themselves as conservatives are pretty much as homeless as people who used to think of themselves as left-wingers, but are a bit kind of grossed out by the whole identity religion thing.
Yeah.
And I suppose politically, I kind of, you know, if there's a Venn diagram of people who are grossed out by identity on one side and people who are grossed out by growth on the other, and there's some sort of intersection there, that's kind of me. Those are my people.
Wow. Yeah, there's this kind of theory that, I guess it's not a theory, but this diagnosis of the current state of the world, at least the Western world, which kind of makes the case that there's this managerial elite that runs everything, these bureaucrats that are not elected, you know, the deep state, which can be taken as a conspiracy in one sense, but also just as reality. If you look at America's federal government, it's this huge behemoth that just kind of feeds on the populace and, you know, kind of divvies up resources in this way or that way. But basically, it's just this huge class of people who are all trained within certain, you know, universities. They're basically the ruling class. Now, there's the super rich and then everybody else, but in between is the people who actually control the world. And they are the actual, their will is what's implemented in government. And I think that a lot of the identity politics stuff is a great way for them to insulate themselves from, you know, the outsiders in a variety of ways, and then enforce conformity with, you know, this kind of basic way of thinking. And then also it could be the case could be made that neoliberalism and neoconservatism, which are about growth, about market economies, are basically, it benefits those people more than it benefits anybody else. And the outsider populations are kind of, you know, we play this game of electing officials and playing in the surface politics, but the people who are really controlling everything are untouchable.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, whether or not pointing it out is going to make any difference is another question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a difficult area to get into because it's sort of hard to talk about without sort of getting into quite kind of tinfoil hat territory. And you know, and I genuinely don't think there's any sort of there's a massive conspiracy going on in any sort of meaningful sense. You know, to a degree, what we have is a kind of emergent property of just the way things have fallen out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really. I don't think there's some kind of great, you know, there isn't a group of lizard people out there who are kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes. You know, there exists a class of people who've organized things by accident or by design, you know, pretty much to suit their own class interests is difficult to dispute. Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps you could say that there's, you know, that it's just in the nature of a ruling class to do that. You know, if I have a problem with it, it's not even, to be honest, with the idea of a ruling class as such, you know, because I think, you know, point to any society which has ever existed with it beyond a rudimentary level of complexity, which does not have a hierarchy and does not have a class system. You know, I think that's very difficult to avoid. You know, if I have a criticism with the emerging managerial elite, if you like, it's that I think the prognosis for their ideology as a kind of long-term sustainer of a functional society is very poor. You know, I think they have their worldview is incredibly antisocial and is just going to send things up in smoke unless it adjusts itself a bit.
Could you Can I take some pot shots at what that ideology is, what that mindset is? And then we can kind of criticize that.
Well, I would, I've characterized it elsewhere as an integralism of the self. I mean, I think we live under a sort of, I don't know if you spend any time on weird Catholic Twitter. It's not really, it's kind of a niche hobby. But on weird Catholic Twitter, a common subject of conversation is integralism, which the Catholics think of as an integral political system, which is where political systems are ordered to Catholicism, so that the whole thing works together. I mean, it's not something I could expand on in detail because I'm not a Catholic and it's really not my thing. Well, but how
did you end up in weird Catholic Twitter then?
Internet rabbit holes are kind of my hobby. That's why okay. I ended up doing what I do, and it's why I write about such an eclectic set of things. I for my sins, I love the internet and I love internet rabbit holes. And weird Catholic Twitter is such a thing. Hello to my friends on weird Catholic Twitter. If anybody's reading this, I love all
Hail
of you.
Mary, full of grace.
let's not offend anybody now.
Could you restate what you were saying about integralism
integralism of the self? So I borrowed the term integralism from weird Catholic Twitter. To describe what I see as an integrated political and moral order, which is now emerging. In my view, we now live under a post-liberal order, but it's not the kind of hobbit, the kind of idealized sort of G.K. Chesterton version of post-liberalism that the kind of tweed-wearing guys like to talk about. It's something much more kind of high-tech and frankly creepy, where, everybody's free to be me, but you're not allowed to actually say or do anything in case you impinge on anybody else's freedom to be me.
Okay.
And pretty much the entire political system is ordered towards protecting the sanctity of the self, and otherwise trying to withhold moral judgment about absolutely anything, and just kind of optimize human physical safety, optimize kind of bare life, and optimize this sort of radical individualism, which is quite customized and quite narcissistic. Again, borrowing memes from the weird right, they're always on about, living in the pod and eating bugs.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of that.
Yeah, you'll own nothing, you'll be happy, but you will be you. You'll be free
to be you. Yeah, but you'll be free to be you. Exactly. Yeah. And, that's how I would characterize, that's the sort of mood board, if you like, for an integralism of the self. I mean, it's at the risk of getting into quite radioactive territory. Pretty much the first move that your new president made upon arriving in government was to sign into, this executive order, which effectively abolishes biological sex in law in favor of how people would like to define themselves. Mm-hmm. And for me, I thought that spoke volumes, because what it speaks to is the idea that there are no natural limits to who we are. We must be liberated to be ourselves, even over and above the constraints of our own bodies, and even over and above sometimes, the class needs of other groups of people who might protest. And it's complete indifference to materiality speaks to me. It's a straightforwardly, it's a religious edict that says, we just don't care about materiality. It's less important than this other domain of the sacred, which we're going to put, which we're going to, give the full force of state authority.
Yes.
And this is what I mean by it's an integral and political moral order. I don't know that it's possible to have a political system without some kind of moral framework behind it. But the moral framework behind the one which is now emerging is very strange, because it, first of all, it disavows the fact that it's a moral framework. It pretends that it's no such thing, that it's just about freedom. But in fact, it has a certain sort of central sacred values, one of which is free to be me. Pretty much the only one, in fact, is free to be me. With a lot of small print, a lot of asterisks, and a lot of small print.
Yeah, that's small print. One of the bigger pieces of small print is that there is a hierarchy of identity that seems to be the more radical the more outlier, the more pretended, the more divorced from reality, that is the most sacred in a certain way. With regards to how do you decide which, if gender reality or gender identity is reality, how you decide which reality is more real than everybody else's? Which person gets more rights than everybody else? And like with women in sports, it's the person who says they are a woman that's more important than the person who simply just is a woman by the accident of biology. So I don't know how that maintains order without devolving into complete chaos and power games. That's how I've seen it play out over and over again.
Well, the short answer is it doesn't. So what you, I mean, the logical, this is what I mean when I say it has a poor long-term prognosis. As a moral order, you know, if you put the full force of the state behind letting people basically inhabit their own reality, it's difficult to see how that can be contained in any state of order, as you say, except without a, you know, as a state which is as repressive as the individual freedom of every single person living under that state is complete. So the more chaotically we can all just pursue our own little realities, the more totally the state has to control everything. Otherwise, it's all just going to go completely to shit. I don't see how that doesn't work. You know, you can't have everybody left to make their own decisions about bigger things like, you know, how do I organise my family, or, you know, is it okay to punch strangers in the street? You can't ever make an assumption that people are just going to do the right thing on that thing, because there is no right thing anymore.
Okay.
Do you see what I'm?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, if you just dynamite the whole concept that there is a right thing that can be done, then you end up having to write rules for absolutely everything. So you end up with this sort of state of total, there are people now, you know, the paranoid right wingers call it soft totalitarianism, don't they? Well, yeah. Perhaps not so paranoid, perhaps just slightly foresightful, I don't know. But the people who are very anxious about this stuff, and certainly people amongst, you know, now dwindling faith communities, are deeply concerned that their ability or, you know, freedom to have a faith in the sense of any sort of a shared meaning which hasn't been subordinate, sort of dissolved by radical individualism, mm-hmm. you know, that freedom is at risk, at serious risk of just being abolished altogether, because mm-hmm. there's something sort of intrinsically exclusionary or dangerous or just too sort of poisonously shared to about their ideologies to be left alone. And I mean, I'm exaggerating for effect a bit here,
yeah.
But this is kind of the discourse.
Well, the departure from a shared moral framework that can be logically ordered, a stable moral framework that we had under the aegis of Christianity and the liberal order that drew a line between your own personal morality and then the enforcement of your morality on other people. Without a certain framework that's both flexible and stable, it seems the people who are into this very radical UBU morality become more and more moralistic and more shrill in their enforcement of this new morality, departing from an older, more stable morality. It's like there's this defensiveness or this fundamentalism that comes in that kind of contradicts with what you were saying about there is no morality, because there are increasingly more and more moralistic people. And with the decline of religion, there's more and more religiosity coming into play.
Well, I mean, one of my theses is that this, you know, what people call rudely and crudely wokeness is not in fact postmodern at all. You know, people say, oh, you know, this is the toxic impact of postmodernism, blah blah blah, and we just have to go back to reason and sensible debate and all sort of being polite to one another and all of that stuff. It's my view that in fact what we call wokeness isn't postmodern at all. It's actually the last stand of high modernism. In the sense that it's realized that meaning, you know, postmodernism radically destabilizes the whole structure of meaning because of, you know, the eternal deferral of meaning and, you know, all of that deconstructionist stuff. And therefore, the only way to push back against this is just to destroy all shared meanings, full stop, and just abolish shared meanings in favor of personal identity.
Yes.
But the problem with that, philosophically, you know, because, you know, if we try and do that and then we also try and continue to exist in the world in relation to other people, You know, we find ourselves in this difficulty where if I try and totally self-create my own identity, I'm not going to know who I am still unless I receive validation from other people. But any sort of validation, but the dependence on other person, on another person's recognition means I'm also vulnerable. You know, just the act of them looking at me threatens me. So anybody who sort of inhabits this way of looking at things is simultaneously desperate for the other person, desperate for recognition, and also absolutely terrified of recognition all the time. And I've been in that state. I was hit really hard by the postmodernism, by the deconstruction train when I went to university. This was ages ago. I'm old. This was like early noughties when it happened to me. And I was in a state of borderline psychosis for a number of years, trying to get my head around what had happened to me there. Recovering from postmodernism took most of my 20s, I reckon. It was brutal. And
tell me about it.
you went there as well.
Oh man, I went there hardcore.
Yeah,
I had to be destroyed several times before I kind of came to a more humble understanding of myself and the world.
It's really rough. It's really rough. And so, and when, you know, when I see these sort of Zoomers, or, you know, 20, 21, 25, I see these kids kind of screaming at the world and, you know, trying to organize everything according to their inner schema. You know, it's very easy to sort of sneer at them or laugh at them or to think, well, you know, this is something, you know, can't they just pull themselves together? But actually, it's an incredibly distressing state of mind to be in. It's really horrible. You know, you're in this state of total existential nakedness and total existential rage all the time. And it's the ideology, you know, it's what you've been taught at university, which has done that to you. I think it's an absolutely brutal thing to do to young people, especially if you're not going to give them any sort of tools or, you know, any kind of helpful practices, you know, to recover from that. And what it took me to recover from it, and this was a long time after it all happened to me. I tried various copes. I had about 10 years worth of copes, I reckon. And what cured it for me was training as a psychotherapist, which sounds a bit kind of off the wall. But what it was an incredibly curative thing to do, because I discovered that there was a postmodern term in psychotherapy as well. You know, they call it the relational term. But this is key. It's not deconstructive. It's actually reconstructive, because what happens, you know, you get the same sort of decentering of objectivity as you do in the whole postmodern dynamic. But the critical thing is just by virtue of the terrain, you know, it's all about the dialogue between you and the other person. So you can't just disappear into solipsism, because otherwise, why the hell are you bothering in the first place? Yeah. You know, besides this, but this guy is going to pay you 50 quid at the end of the session anyway. And that's real enough. OK, so you've got to find a way of accounting for your own decenteredness as a subject, and also the other person's sort of decentered subjectivity, in a way which still allows for talk and communication and growth, which is just radically at odds with the very academic postmodernism, which just goes off on this kind of nihilistic one where everything is power, like there are no values, there's no meaning, and everything is power. And instead, it goes off into something which I think is quite beautiful and quite accepting, that says, okay, we're both in this mess, but we're in it together. And we have to, you know, we have a responsibility to own our own shit, but we also have a responsibility to do our best to hear the other person, in the full knowledge that chances are you're going to get it wrong most of the time. And it becomes just a radically self-accepting and radically kind of, you know, there's a willingness to reveal yourself as a therapist comes into the dynamic in a way which just isn't the case. You know, there's a lot of discussion in relational psychoanalysis about, you know, when and where it's appropriate to reveal what's going on for you as the analyst, which is just totally at odds with what happens in more classical psychotherapy, where the analyst is objective and separate and detached and supposedly, you know, remains a kind of blank page. And within the relational turn, it's much more of a dialogue, and it's much more connected, and it's much more, it's much less polarized between a supposedly objective observer and a supposedly completely kind of open and exposed subject. And it's experiencing that, you know, and practicing with that and working with that and kind of taking all of those theories on board against this very sort of nihilistic and valueless encounter I'd had with the postmodern turn at university was phenomenally healing. And it just gave me a very different angle on how you can incorporate that insight of sort of the way in which, you know, from a postmodern point of view, it's like the world is looking back at you. You know, suddenly, you know, your reality isn't solid anymore. And there's a sense in which everything's just made of meanings. But, mm-hmm. you know, having experienced a much more, having discovered a much more relational way of engaging with that kind of semiotic slippiness, I just decided that, fine, okay, so I look at the world and the world is looking back at me a bit and everything's in continual relative motion, so who cares? So what? Everything's moving a bit and I'm moving with it.
Okay.
And?
But that who cares isn't a nihilistic who cares. It's like,
no,
okay.
No, it isn't. It's just like, whatever, fine. I've still got to get up in the morning and I've still got to talk to people.
Okay.
You know, and I've still got to, you know, there's still stuff which is worth doing. And the other is there. You know, and they've got their shit going on as well. And, you know, we just have to kind of muddle through, I guess. You know, that it sounds so lame when you put it like that, but it's from as a shift in perspective from that very sort of lonely, that lonely kind of relativism. You know, I found it, you know, suddenly postmodernism is this incredibly rich domain. You know, if instead of exhausting culture, it just opens it all up. You know, and it was as though I'd been looking at something in photographic negative that was suddenly the lights came on and I could see the world in color. It was just and suddenly, you know, viewed through that light. Deconstruction is not, it doesn't have to be a destructive thing. You can also do reconstruction with it.
Yeah, I keep on saying that. People don't believe me.
It's true, though. It's true. You just have to make the leap of faith that says, no, actually, the world is out there.
It's very terrifying to internalize the insight that everything is relative, everything is power, everything is always dominated by, there might be a veneer of objectivity or a veneer of, you know, whatever face is on the different sorts of transactions that we interact. It's always a cover for something deeper, primordial. It's just kind of levers and hydraulics of energy going around in all these different ways. Once you see that mask, you get shooken from my own perspective, growing up a Christian, kind of having this realization that God is God and the way that we dress up God is completely arbitrary and just has to do with a bunch of different accidents that evolved over time into something that's stable enough for human beings to collectively worship that which is, or collectively name that which is nameless. But I went into this complete free fall, which was that first moment in my early 20s, breaking out of that, there was tremendous amounts of energy because I was free and I was releasing all the energy in that wild deconstruction of myself, my morality, and everything that I had inherited. But at the end of that, I was completely exhausted, completely devoid of purpose and direction, and I had to go through multiple phases of reconstructing myself. And so I understand people from a traditional mindset or conservative mindset say, don't go there. Don't leap out of there because that way lies ruin. You look into the abyss and that's all you're going to see. Not only does it look into you, but that's all you're ever going to see. But when you get through that phase to the other side of that, you have all these tools in your pocket to say that I don't need to break down Christianity. I don't need to break down Islam. I don't need to break down neo-capitalism or whatever. I can do that. But I know that at the other end, I'm trying to make meaning that connects with other people. Ultimately, I'm trying to stir up other people.
Yes.
And then collectively, we're making this consensus reality. Mm-hmm. But if we're responsible with that, we can still do it logically. We can still tie it to biology. We don't need to go into radical identity politics.
Yes. All of that. It sounds like you and I came to a pretty similar place in terms of... Yeah. Okay. So now we have to reconstruct. So now what? Here we are.
And then you have infinite material, basically, as an artist, as a writer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can go on a run. And you're like, okay, I can do this with this. You can do anything with anything at this point, because you are grounded between possibility and actuality. Like, there's a more mature relationship after you give yourself over to that process.
Yeah, I think so. And it's also, as you say, a slightly more humble way of approaching the mimetic field, you know, if you like, the symbolic field,
yeah.
You know, the whole field of meanings. I had a great friend, I say had, because very sadly she died last year, who, an extraordinary woman, a writer called Wendy Wheeler, who was a pioneer in the field of biosemiotics, which is a very, yeah, I know, you really need to go there if you're interested in this stuff. But it's the study of meaning-making in the natural world and across the natural and the human worlds, basically applying the ideas of, you know, semiotic dialogue to biological and even sort of, you know, organic chemical principles, you know, taking the idea that actually the world is not made of information, it's made of meanings, and the dialogues between different creatures and different species and different, you know, ecological systems within the natural world are, you know, they're interchanges of meanings, you know, very much like, you know, the history of ideas, you know, the way ideas evolve in relation to one another, you know, is an interaction, you know, between larger and small, you know, the greater and smaller megafauna of the domain of, you know, history of ideas. You know, you can see big ideas kind of blundering across the savannah and little ones kind of swarming, you know what I mean, you know the sort of thing I mean. But of course that happens in the natural world as well. You know, in a sense, you know, this an analogous process of meaning making is at work in the natural world as well, and to an extent, you know, and it also gives you a lens for looking at the way the human world dialogues with the rest of our planet, because it's not as though there is no interaction. I mean, if you one example I found which I really love is it's a species of North American moth. This is going to sound like I'm going off on some really bizarre tangent, but bear with me for a moment. It's a species of moth which is generally, it can be born either almost completely white or almost completely black, and it's just a kind of, you know, throw of the dice. But I believe it used to be that they were almost all white because of something to do with their environment and the way they camouflaged themselves meant that it was just more advantageous for these moths to be born white rather than black. Yeah. But over the course of the 20th century, that has reversed, because pollution in the areas in which these moths tend to inhabit has been such that actually the backgrounds that they live on have changed colour. So natural selection over time has made it more advantageous, you know, in dialogue with human civilization, you know, for better or for worse, has changed the colour of these moths over the course of a few decades, maybe 100 years. So in a sense the dialogue of those moths as a species with their environment includes a dialogue with the human world and its environment. And it's not as though those two things are separable from one another.
Could we explain the difference between information and meaning? Because meaning is built out of information, but it's not reducible to information. Just like a sentence is reducible to words, but it's made of words, but not reducible to words. Is that correct?
I mean, the way Wendy would put it, I'm going to have to quote her here because she's much better on this than me. She borrows a lot from an information theory, but, you know, very 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 crudely, she would say that information theory is the study of the exception. It's the anomalous signal. So if you're listening out in a whole load of crackle for the voice, you know, and the voice is in a sense the exception to the crackle.
Okay.
If you understand it, but the study of meaning,
signal to noise. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Information theory is looking for the signal, not looking for the noise. But meaning is the noise.
So meaning except for that isolated signal.
Yeah, everything except the anomalies. Meaning, information is the thing that stands out. Okay. Meaning is the ordinary patterns that everybody just tunes out because that's just what always happens.
Okay. But if everything is built out of meaning, or we're continually engaging with meaning, we're not just chaotic forms in this soup of
it's not as though, you know, it's not, because it's not noise. That's the point. It's only from the point of view of information theory that meaning is just noise or irrelevant or nothing or just to be filtered out. You know, in fact, the whole domain of meaning is, you know, immensely complicated and worth studying in its own right.
Yeah.
I mean, as an analogy which I made on this is what it's like being a mother to a very small child. You know, the days just kind of bleed into one another because, you know, it's pretty repetitive looking after a small baby. Mm-hmm. You know, the babies are lovely, but they're not great conversationalists. And, you know, somebody might say, oh, you know, how was your day? And you'd say, oh, my my daughter said bat for the first time, and that would be the signal. But in fact, the what was significant about the day was everything that went the way it normally does. You know, the fact that we got up at the same time as every day, and the fact that, you know, she needed changing X number of times, and she had X number of naps, and these things are or aren't the same as what happened the day before. You know, all of that is incredibly rich information if you're a mother. And if you listen to a mother more than a parent, I'm sorry, but, you know, if you listen to a parent doing handover with a childcare person, they'll communicate all sorts of things about about what was ordinary about the day, and also as well as what was extraordinary about the day. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, the study mm-hmm. of meaning is the study of what's ordinary, and the study of information is the study of what's extraordinary.
Okay.
You know, and they're both useful kinds of information, but in the context of a child, it's as important to know what about the ordinary as it is to know about the extraordinary, to know about the patterns. You know, it's if I'm looking after a baby, I need to know when she normally sleeps, for example. You know, I don't just
and
want
what
to
all
know.
The different signs mean, the body language,
right, exactly.
Like when she starts getting grumpy, you know, whether it's because of food or bigger problem, another instability in her life that you need to help her figure out how to manage.
Right, exactly. You know, you need all of that context. You need all of that ordinary in order to make any sense of the extraordinary. You know, in a sense, you know, we're a bit lost in trying to parse the domain of meaning, and you know, whether it's in the natural world or in the human world, because we're massively, massively hyper attuned to signal, and not and are just dismissing everything else as noise. You know, at a very fundamental level, that's why I think mothers and what mothers do, and you know, infant care and you know the care of small children is so marginalized in the modern world, because almost all of it is about meaning, not information.
You and know, that's
so,
why
it's all in that very embedded and relational sort of a concept.
There's this concept of unpaid labor that's usually assigned to women in the home, taking care of children and maintaining a clean house. It seems like calling that unpaid labor is the attempt for the information economy to attach information, to quantify,
and to reduce all that
life into something that can be paid or unpaid or
politicized
in some way.
I reject that whole framework. I question that whole framework because I don't think it doesn't help, because all you're ever really doing if you do that is trying, as you say, trying to bring it into the world of information to try and make it make sense in those terms. But it's never going to make sense in those terms, because it's precisely it's all the stuff which doesn't make sense in those terms.
Yeah.
And if you try and turn one thing, it's like trying to teach a penguin how to do ballet. It's just not going to work.
Well, unless you deform the penguin
might kind of do something that looks a bit like ballet, but at the end of the day, the penguin's going to hate it, and it's going to be a bad ballet.
Okay. Yeah.
Just don't do that.
I really think I've been toying with this for a really long time, and it does come from my experience working with children and kind of being, kind of taking a parental role and doing mothering and fathering and understanding mm-hmm. the balance of those two patterns of behavior and the need to switch between one and the other in order to optimize how the child is going to attenuate themselves to themselves and the world. But I've thought for a very long time that academic feminism, went about trying to understand and promote the female in an academic, very dry or masculine form of knowledge of information. And if you really want to understand what it is to be female, you need to understand the novel. The novel is the way in which it communicates the breadth of experience of what it is to be a woman and to go through all of that support work that's behind history, which I thought of as heresy. That's just an idea that I've been toying with, and I know it's very impartial, but I like to use that as a stepping stone into like understanding what you think of as the proper way to conceptualize the mother, the female, and the feminine.
I can't pretend to have any sort of a last word on that. Although, just sort of thinking about women and the novel, if that's a line of thought that interests you, you should have a look at the moral panic around women reading novels in the 18th century, because it was a moral panic. You know, people.
Oh no.
There was a full scale sort of conservative. I think it was. I don't even know whether it was conservative or what it was, but people were deeply concerned about women from the aristocratic class down to your serving maid, that instead of doing whatever it was that women were supposed to be doing, they'd be lolling around on sofas reading sensationalist novels. And it was a full fledged, possibly the first full fat modern moral panic. it might just I'm not sure how it's relevant to what you're saying, but my gut feeling is it kind of is.
Yeah.
There's this sense that, you know, perhaps it's just, you know, women reading about themselves, you know, is sort of somehow deeply dangerous. I mean, the short answer to that is I don't know. I think part of the reason why it's difficult to talk about women and femaleness is because it's so contextual. One of the things I think about a lot is the ancient Jungian archetypes of the different ages of woman, you know, the maiden, the mother, and the crone, which is just not something which I think is desperately, painfully absent from feminism. You know, there's a lot of what we think of as academic feminism really just centres the maiden.
Yeah.
There's a little bit about the mother, but mostly as a problem to be solved. And a little bit about the crone, but only in the sense of, actually these days, of mostly just being an embarrassment to be shut up because they know that biological sex exists.
Mm.
You know, that's pretty much the only relationship that that academic mainstream feminism has with older women.
Yeah.
You know, there's certainly no sense of, the time-honored position of older women, which was taking a step back from raising their own children and telling everybody else how to live their lives. You know, old women used to be the guardians of, you know, the ultimate weaponizers of public shame in the interests of, you know, general pro-social mores. And I think women need to reclaim that. This is one of my slightly more radioactive opinions. I think the reactionary feminist move from where we are is that the liberals by saying that we don't need shame anymore, and in fact shaming people is deeply bad and wrong, and you can't even shame people with incredibly disgusting sexual kinks because that's just wrong somehow. You're not allowed to shame anybody, lest you be shamed back. I think women have kneecapped themselves really badly in that way, just in terms of, you know, the relative balance of power of the sexes, because men, just by virtue of their biology, are always going to be stronger, and they're always going to be more aggressive, and they're always going to be more violent. So if we, but...
And obsessive.
And obsessive, and all of these things, you know, the male is more aggressive, more violent, and et cetera, and so on, but... You know, it is my observation. I don't have any data on this, but it's my observation that men are morbidly terrified of being shamed, and they will also do almost anything in their power to make the women they love happy. So it's my view that women want to, you know, that there's no point in trying to be as aggressive as men because it's just never going to happen. And if you're not going to wield the power of public shame, that just leaves you with no option but to become this sort of tribally mobilizer of legislation. That's all you have left. So it's kind of not surprising that we find ourselves in a position where women are, you know, alternately sort of crying about how oppressed we are, and then demanding new laws to control how everybody can behave so that we're not oppressed like that anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we'd only rediscover our power to shame men when they do things which are bad and wrong and disgusting, you know, a lot of that would probably just go away. I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit idealistic here, but I feel like... And it would also leave older women with something, you know, because young women can wield a certain amount of power by weaponizing just being hot.
Yeah.
But you know, that inevitably that dissipates with time. You know, we all become old and saggy in the end. And if you can't weaponize your hotness and you can't shame people, then you really do have nothing left. So it's no wonder that older women are really desperately marginalized. No, mm-hmm. I think for the sake of the crones of this world, and actually for the sake of the world in general, we need shame back. And specifically as a feminist project, I think we need to reclaim public shaming.
Well, as long as there's some sort of measurement of accountability to keep you guys in line. I mean, as long as the shame is wielded by wisdom, and without wisdom, I don't want that. I don't think that it'd be good just to bring out that nuclear weapon again.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. You know, you need, which actually, it kind of brings us back to shared values, doesn't it? You know, because if you can't really mobilize public shame unless there are shared values, and perhaps that's the problem. You know, as long as you have an integralism of the self rather than any sort of a shared moral framework, you know, public shaming doesn't really work, because you have to whip up the mob. You know, you can't just rely on all of the other old biddies to also tuck with you about the same stuff necessarily.
Well, the relationship of the, let's just say, the crone to the power over the community is deeply, deeply rooted in the personal. She has that power, yes, because everybody has known her from birth, and she knows everybody from their most most powerful state. And in this kind of evaporated realm of social media, there is no personal connection. There's only personality connections. So the power of that form of femininity that is so rooted in community isn't there, because there isn't that actual community.
Yep. I think that's accurate. You know, what you do about that, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a whole lot that can be done apart from, you know, enough people taking a personal decision that they're just going to commit to a place and actually talking to their neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really know that there is much else that we can do.
Yeah, we're all lost in the anywhere. And so there has to be new moral frameworks to give us a compass. There has to be a compass within anywhere. And right now the magnetic forces are just spinning us around and spinning us around, and it's all about
power. Yeah, I wonder whether that's even realistic, or whether it mightn't just be more pragmatic to just opt out altogether and, you know, make a sort of mutiny of the consciously self-chosen somewheres. You know, we might all be anywheres, but it doesn't mean we can't choose to be somewheres. I mean, Paul Kingsnorth wrote a really lovely essay about national character, which he believes completely is a thing. I agree with him. National character is a thing, but in his view, it's not based on anything as ridiculous as, you know, somebody's DNA. It's based on what it's like to inhabit that place.
Mm-hmm.
And the habits of a culture that accumulate over time, just by virtue of, you know, developing a relationship with a place, you know, what the texture of the soil, or the shape of the footpaths, or, you know, what the different colours that the landscape has, or whatever, you know, the different places affect people in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, you're obviously going to develop quite a different national character if it's too hot to work for 4 hours in the middle of the afternoon than it is if you live in a temperate climate. You know, these things are fairly obvious when you think about it. And perhaps it's not even possible to have developed a class of anywheres full stop, you know, if we didn't have mechanical climate control, you know, if we didn't have central heating and air conditioning. You know, it would not even have been possible to export a sort of temperate climate work ethic to somewhere like Abu Dhabi. You know, so it's... I mean, I'm riffing a bit here, but my point is... But just bringing it back to communities and shared values, you know, rather than sort of, you know, sticking my pin in the map and saying, well, you know, my vote is for Christianity, or my vote is for this ism or that ism. I'd say, you know, if we actually just got offline a little bit more, she says, talking to you on the internet, and spent a bit more time walking around our places, you know, we might find that, you know, in common with other people who live in those places, we can derive enough of a set of common values just out of living there together, and the things that we have to do in order to make that work. You know, I don't really see any other way that we're going to end up actually really being able to reconstruct something. I don't see any other way it's going to go.
To echo back to that novel insight, which I've actually replicated in my fiction, about this realm of the memoverse that is actually inhabited by creatures. Like if you think of fiction as this realm where there's all these invented forms that kind of gamble about, you can see these big lumbering epics and these small little poems flying around. Mm-hmm. Within what we call echo chambers are the recreation of a space that's created out of memes, or out of ideas, or out of identities and group behaviors. And we are experimenting with uploading ourselves into this internet space that is formed out of relationships and environments and even temperatures of discourse, right? And the how fast the information flows, what kind of emotionalities involved, the moderator or the self-governing principles moderate the temperature of that information and how people kind of come to be. It could be the case that we are experimenting and we can't go back. I don't think we can go back to, all the lights turn off, we're not going to go back to
the pretense. I hope it's not in my lifetime.
Well, it's happening in Texas right now, so. You know,
it is.
Right.
It is. that's but a joke.
But if we enough. If we kind of revisit that one-toned critique of the echo chamber and see it as there's these tribes that are trying to reform space that's built out of something that's not connected to a reality or a rhythm of day and night cycle. It's connected to just people uploading constantly their information. We can navigate that a little bit better and understand that we're in, like you said, with weird Catholic Twitter, or there's different domains of Twitter where you step in and you're like, okay, these people use GIFs all the time. They're always reacting with GIFs, and you kind of adapt yourself to the flow of information there. Or like this new app called Clubhouse, which is just built out of conversations, and it's a kind of a reboot of a chat room. But the way that information flows in there is kind of enlightening or lightening up certain other aspects of human behavior. These are just kind of ideas. If we can understand the terrain of this stuff, we can we can not just critique certain patterns of behavior, but we can actually understand and engage with them and then bring everybody kind of awake to what's actually happening. And we can build better houses, build better commerce and places there.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. I mean, in my more kind of black pilled moments, you know, by my theory of the social media kind of devouring of everything is that it starts out mediating, and then it moves to replacing whatever it started out mediating, and finally it grotesquely parodies it, and that's just the natural trajectory of digital communications.
Could you walk that through with an example, mediating, replacing, parodying?
Let me think. So I'm trying to think of a good example, because there are loads, but it's picking out a really good juicy one.
Yeah.
So I suppose a good example would be local newspapers. If you think about Facebook might start out mapping local community connections. And it would start out just facilitating communications amongst people in the local community, say, but before long, it stops just mediating, and it comes to replace, say, local newspapers, or, you know, a whole bunch of social structures that were there before. You know, suddenly the local newspaper can't afford, you know, the local newspaper, which was free but which ran on small ads, can't run anymore because it's not needed, because Facebook carries all of those communications that used to go into the small ads, and then you take it on a step further from that, and suddenly your neighbors are all having fights about dog shit in the park, and it's gone from mediating to replacing to grotesquely parodying a local newspaper and the job that a local newspaper did within a local community. Do you see what I'm saying? And,
yes.
and I see that as the template for how digital communications rips through the social. You know, I mean, just for a bit of context, you know, I'm kind of addicted to the internet, and I love the internet, and I have been just obsessed with it pretty much since I discovered it existed in about 1998. So I say all of this kind of with love, but also with hatred, because I see what it's doing, and yeah, I have a very ambivalent relationship to the internet. I love it.
There's
got to
be another step, though, once everybody exhausts their argumentation. Right.
But what is that? Because that's kind of where we are right now. We're in this world where it feels like we're getting to the point where it's just grotesquely parodying absolutely everything. You know, even just like the entirety of democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Is now
yeah.
being
that
grotesquely.
Trump, you can see Trump as the grotesque parody of the presidential.
Everything that happened, you know, on January the 6th at the center of your government, you know, it felt like it was. All of the paranoia which was mobilized in that day and in that event, you know, had all been fanned by internet communications, you know, in a sense, you know, stuff which had grown up in the disintegration of the social, locally
yeah.
speaking,
yeah.
You know, where people are sending these paranoid fantasies back and forth because it's better to almost kind of feel something. And they genuinely believed that they were the ones saving democracy. You know, and you know, who in fact, who will the real Democrats, will the, yeah, they everybody believed that they were saved. Both sides believed that they were, you know, that they were the ones who were saving democracy there. And I think, you know, many PhDs, I imagine, will be written on the truth of what actually went down that day. But yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, the digital communication grotesquely parodying something, you know, democracy is a case in point.
Yeah.
That's kind of gender. Where we are. Yep.
Race.
Yeah, I mean, right. Yep. You know, when you start treating identity as something, as sort of something analogous to an avatar, which we can edit and update anytime we want because it's separable from our bodies, then, yeah, it's going to become a sort of grotesque parody of itself because it has no referent in the real world.
Yes.
It's bizarre. I discovered my old Live Journal. I don't know if you remember Live Journal.
Yeah.
I went digging back through my old Live Journal from like 2005 or something and discovered that I was very active on a now defunct London lesbian community for a number of years. And one of the things that people were just beginning to really obsess about there was how they identified. And it really was a kind of product of internet culture, because, you know, here were all of these people who looked like whatever they looked like in real life. Maybe they wore their hair a bit longer or a bit shorter. But on the internet, with none of that to cross-reference against, it was all about how you felt on the inside. Oh, I identify as a this and I identify as that. And everybody was coming up with new terms for, you know, new subcategories of, am I completely lesbian or am I this or am I that? And also, the transgender thing was just taking off at the same time. And I don't think it's a coincidence that those two things came together, because it really is about a sort of internet-enabled understanding of identity. Yeah. Which is detachable from the body, and it's detachable from sex.
Yeah, I mean, sex has become detached from the physical body through the mediating influence of pornography. Yeah. It mediated sexual desire. It replaced sexual activity between bodies, and now it's a grotesque, constantly slips into grotesque parody of itself. You said referent to the real world is kind of where things kind of slip. Without that referent to something in the real world, like the embodied experience, the actual relationships that you have in your community, if we can't return to that, can we not just kind of stockpile enough information in the internet that that becomes a real referent? If there's enough of a sense of self that you accumulate over time in the internet that people can refer to, I don't know. There's a beginning of an idea there to kind of move past the stage of infinite parody or of grotesque parody. We can't go back unless the lights turn off. So if we don't turn off the lights, what's going to happen?
I don't know. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot recently is what's left over from the internet, the supplement. You know, to borrow a phrase from the deconstructionists, you know, the supplement, the bit of meaning which isn't captured by the definition which you try and put on it in language. You know, there's always something left over, and that's why you end up with this eternal deferral of meaning, you know, in the postmodern, in the deconstruction, the post-structuralist analysis. And, you know, in what the internet first mediates and then replaces and then grotesquely parodies, there's always something which is left over. You know, it's the body is left over from it. But there are also certain kinds of communication which are just more difficult or downright impossible on the internet. There are certain conversations which I refuse to have via direct message, for example. There are certain things which I don't even like saying over the phone, or certain kinds of, you know, for example, I would never, I mean, I'm happily married now, so it's academic, but I would never dump somebody by email, even when I was dating, because to me it's just wrong to do that, not in person. I've been thinking about this in the context of Leo Strauss and his famous essay on persecution and the art of language, where he writes about the double meanings encoded in the writings of serious thinkers at times when persecution was just a norm, and, you know, the orthodoxies of what it was and wasn't permissible to say are very strong. So you could get punished or, you know, tortured or ostracized or whatever for saying things which are considered bad. And his argument, it's a subtle argument, and I'm butchering it horribly here, but his argument is that, you know, if you learn to read carefully, you can discern a trail of, you know, secondary meanings in the texts that come out of this time, which were intentionally laid for somebody with the right education and the right set of references to be able to follow it and figure out the extra layer to whatever it is that's being said. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think about a lot is the emergence of a new poetics of dog whistling for the internet, and a new art of not saying, actually, of not spelling it out, a new art of saving certain things for in real life, a new practice and a meditation of understanding what it is actually not appropriate to digitize. And there are plenty of things which work just fine on the internet, and if we're not going to turn all of the lights out, and I sincerely hope that doesn't happen in my lifetime, you know, there are lots of ways that the internet makes our lives a whole lot easier, but I think we could do with developing a much more conscious practice for what we intentionally choose not to digitize and what we intentionally choose to practice, or, you know, to reserve for other domains.
Yeah,
what we choose to leave out. What we choose to leave unstated.
Yeah, I practice that in crafting my identity, because I'm not just a user now. I'm a content creator. I'm a personality.
Right.
So I have to be aware of what I'm doing, what I'm uploading, how I interact with my audience and with the world at large, and just being conscious about that in order to survive. Right. Basically. And one thing that I developed is that I don't like arguing in comment fields, so I'm not going to be argumentative, and I'm not going to take the bait. I'm not going to do a back and forth, because I'm not going to put my emotion down. Plus, there's an asymmetry. Somebody accused me of being a homophobe like Putin the other day, and I commented on their way. I critiqued how the form of calling people a phobe. I just critiqued that. I didn't answer the actual accusation, but I said I don't trust the framework that goes around and interprets things as a phobia, because you're only looking at one thing and you're assigning intention to it, and you're denying other ways of reading that in order to gain some sort of standing as somebody who has the power to judge somebody as being afraid or having a phobe or whatever. And then somebody is like, well, you're deflecting. I will answer that, but not in a comment. I will answer criticism when I can perform them in front of a camera, because you can hear my voice, you can hear my tone, and then it's more real to me, and I'm not subject to some anonymous account defining terms and then constantly twisting my words to suit their argument. I'm not going to do that. So that's one example of knowing where my medium of argumentation and of rhetoric goes, where I can put certain thoughts in one form, not another.
I feel like we would all, you know, all of us who are very online in one form or another would benefit from thinking a lot more openly and a lot more, you know, thinking more publicly about this. You know, I mean, perhaps it would be hopelessly meta for most people. But I guess, you know, that there are very simple principles, like never argue with somebody who has symbols in their Twitter bio. Just don't do it.
What do you mean, like symbols?
You know, when they have like flags or hashtags or little emojis or something in their Twitter bio, you know, it's a solid rule of thumb just not to get into an argument with those people. You know what I'm saying. Just don't bother. Because it's not worth anybody's time. And it's like the Chinese proverb, you know, never wrestle a pig because you'll only get dirty, and besides, the pig likes it. Don't do it.
Exactly.
And, you know, sort of, you know, jumping to a slightly different domain, I often bring myself into my writing, but I do that. And it might look as though I'm being quite exposing doing that. But there's generally a lot of reflection that goes into where I do or don't decide to bring, even sometimes quite personal stories. And I'm happy to do that, but there's always a lot of thought that goes into it. You know, it says, you know, is this actually something that I want to share? Is this something that I'm comfortable sharing? You know, how does this contribute to the picture of me that's out there? You know, is this, and it's a judgment call every time. But there's also a me which is just not subject to that. And there are boundaries, you know, and I don't necessarily know what they are until I meet one. But they're there, and there are aspects of myself which are not available for digitization, and that's just non-negotiable. And I think it's important to be very conscious about that, because if one isn't, then, you know, the principle of mediating and then replacing and grotesquely parodying applies there as well.
There's a way in which I think you and I both went through this. We talked about going through the 20s, the postmodernism, losing our ground and flying into the crazy world of anything could be anything. But there's also a, with regards to being meta or to being self-referential as a thinker, is something that people in their 20s do compulsory. People who are more mature learn to contextualize the self, and going through that phase, or knowing when somebody, your interlocutor, whoever you're speaking to, is in a certain phase of personal development where they're not necessarily narcissistic so much as they're just in a stage where they're always thinking through themselves and they can't escape themselves. So they're always referring everything to themselves. It was very relieving for me when I passed through that, and I could command when I brought myself into my work, and then because it was constellated with other things, but it took me a long time to get over myself in that way.
Again, psychotherapy training is a fairly kind of brutal, few short years of boot camp on that, because it involves an enormous amount of feedback from your fellow trainees. You know, you're reflected back to yourself in sometimes fairly, always gently, always kindly, but often unflinchingly by the people that you're working with. In a way, you build up an enormous amount of trust, but people reflect the you that you are, as they see it, back to you in a way which is illuminating, but, can sometimes kind of shake you absolutely to the core, and things you believed about yourself just turn out to really not be true. And ways you believed you come across just really turn out not to be how the rest of the world sees you at all. But after a while, you build up a more kind of relational, a more textured picture. And I suppose all of that happened when I was in my early 30s, which is about the kind of point you're talking about anyway. So it accelerated that process in a way I was profoundly grateful for. Made it a lot more comfortable and a lot less experimental being me than perhaps it had been before.
To go back to that idea that I was trying to grapple for towards creating stability within a realm of experience that's not directly related to solid reality. So this realm of identity and the realm of the internet without a referral to the stability of diurnal rhythms of actual work of the actual body has a bunch of problems in it. If we can form trust, if we can use trust as a way to build stability within a relational poetics of the internet, of internet personalities, that would be like the goal. Or if we can form trust, then we can actually begin to build something that's more real in the way that we communicate with each other online. If we look at it as trust, then we're going to have to investigate, well, what can formulate trust? What's that built out of? And I look at the way in which institutions such as the New York Times are expending their authority. They're now captured by ideology, and the truth is something secondary to getting their way, in a way. So these institutions are devolving in their ability for me to trust them, which went away a long time, but more and more people are distrusting these institutions. And now I go and I defer my trust to the individual writer, the individual journalist. If they have a name, if I see that they have a set of standards that they apply to themselves, then I still form trust, but it's no longer with the institution because I know that the institutions are captured. But I can still learn to trust individuals because I over time, I see how they behave.
Ultimately, I don't think there's anything that really builds trust apart from mutual interdependence. If the difficulty with trying to create interdependence on the internet is that the whole thing is premised on being able to log on and log off as you please. That's pretty much how the whole thing was built. You opt in or opt out as you like. And so, it forecloses the domain of actual interdependence pretty much from the word go. In the sense that I'm interdependent with my husband and my daughter. They rely on me and I rely on them. And that's an absolutely rock solid, incredibly textured set of obligations, which I'm committed to. And that's a huge part of my world and what matters to me. And the internet is designed to be everything but that. You know, you're never really interdependent with you can be well known on the internet, but in a sense you can always slip away, and that's how it's designed, and that's the appeal of it. You can drift in and out of conversations.
Yeah, and you can block people that's sending information that they want to see. Yeah.
You know, I can't block my husband just because he says something slightly rude to me about what I'm wearing today. Yeah. I mean, I could, but you know, it's not going to be a very functional marriage for very long if I do that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're two diametrically opposed ways of relating to people. And I suppose, you know, if you can imagine some form of internet where we're interdependent with one another, then, yeah. As in really, really, truly, genuinely interdependent with one another, then perhaps I can see something like what you're describing taking place. But until that happens, then, you know, I'm skeptical that we're going to be able to replace.
Well, I think it's going to happen no matter what. I think that as you write and as your voice gets out there and you attract an audience and then you attract conversations and put yourself out there more and more and more, you become stabilized in there and then you form a sense of responsibility to your identity, your personality that you've crafted, but also that's reflected in the people that are responding to you and starting to trust you through your information, through somebody as a voice. I think that we replicate that as we proceed and as we formulate solid relationships that aren't just formed out of agreement or likes, but something
this
more
is interesting.
Than that.
So you're talking about a kind of ethics of leadership in a meme community. That's what you're talking about, really, isn't it?
Is it leadership? Is that the...
Yeah, that's what you're describing.
Okay.
You have a significant platform. I'm kind of nobody. But you have a meaningful.
I think you have the makings of being somebody, though. You're not just anybody anymore. We'll tell you that.
You're very kind, but I mean, you have a significant platform, and you know, regular viewers, and you know, this very sort of textured, and well established kind of dialogue with a whole sort of memetic community, if you like, a virtual community, and what you're describing is an ethic of interdependence with that community. Or an ethical interdependence with that community.
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, that community sustains you, and you're a trusted figure, you know, for a community. And it's a relationship which isn't just a fly by night thing. I can see what you're saying, and in that context, I can completely understand how you might be talking about a sort of stabilized identity. You know, but being an anonymous, you know, but being an egg on Twitter is a different ballgame.
Yeah, it is.
The point where I stopped being anonymous, my Twitter account that I tweet from now it started out as my alt, and I was still anonymous when I started writing for Unheard, and I think I was sort of 2 or 3 months into having written for them pretty much every week when I made the momentous decision that I was going to go anonymous because it just seemed really stupid to have my actual name bylined on Unheard when I was anonymous. So I was anonymous on Twitter. I just thought this doesn't really make sense. So I went anonymous, and I think I went back and deleted my entire Twitter history up to that point before I did go anonymous. Just
you did the great reset.
What was there. I did the great reset, and I don't think it was a stupid thing to do because I couldn't remember what I said about what, and I didn't give a shit who read it.
Yeah.
You know, but this comes back again to the poetics of dog whistling and the poetics of what's left unsaid on the internet, doesn't it? You know, the idea that actually, you know, there are some things which it's better not to say, or that it's better not to say online, and that actually there's a personal and an ethical and also an aesthetic dimension to that.
And that changes between you can say the unsaid when you're anonymous because it's not tracing back to you, or you don't care. Once you start to tie your real life to yourself, then you start thinking about the game differently.
And it's just, you know, there are people who are like, well, you know, I should just be able to say what I like, but you know, either those people are lying to themselves or they have the hide of a rhino, or possibly both. I don't know. Well, there are some people who are just kind of slightly sociopathic and just genuinely don't care, but I really think they're a very small minority.
Yeah. What do you want to do on the internet now that you're Mary Harrington?
I don't know. I mean, I've just been sort of I just like writing. I like internet rabbit holes, and I like writing about stuff. I've got about 10 books that I quite like to write, which I may or may not get around to writing. There's an argument I want to make about why feminism against progress is the argument I want to make at the moment.
Could you give me a byline for that? Feminism against progress.
I think this is
why I reached out to you originally.
Well, because I think feminism should oppose progress.
No, just your ideas on feminism, but feminism against progress.
Feminism against progress. It's my view that the idea of progress is very, very difficult to disaggregate from feminism because the two have sort of emerged together, and it's pretty much taken as axiomatic that the word being to be a feminist is to be progressive. Yes. I contest that idea because I think I don't believe in progress. I am a progress atheist, which makes me in the 21st century something a bit like being a Christian, an atheist. It would have been in the 17th century. It basically means moral dropout. If you don't believe
you
in progress.
By progress, you're not talking about iterative improvement of technology.
No,
or
I mean
of societies.
I mean human progress. I don't think there's any meaningful sense in which humans are better now than we were, say, 3,000 years ago. I just think that's a bullshit idea.
Institutions can progress in their refinement, but not human behavior.
No, I don't think institutions really progress either. I just think there are always trade-offs. You know, some things get better, but other things get worse. I don't believe taken in total that humans progress. I just think things change and evolve.
Okay.
It doesn't mean things change. But anyway, I think
you use the word evolve, which is kind of tied to progress.
Right, but there's no moral value attached to evolving. I mean, this was the biggest mistake people made in the way they read what Charles Darwin was talking about. You know, he talked about survival of the fittest, and people have moralized that idea as though fittest means best. But in fact, fittest just means most appropriately adapted for its specific context.
Yes, yes, yeah.
You know, there's no moral sense attached to it at all. You know, just because the North American peppered moth is on average a slightly different color now than it was 100 years ago, doesn't make it better or worse. It just makes it more efficiently adapted to being camouflaged in a more polluted environment.
Yeah.
You know, how
can we overlay that with how feminism sought to adapt females to the modern environment? And
there's a very, 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 very long answer to that. But I mean, in my view, feminism is just the latest iteration in a very ancient conversation, which is namely, how can men and women live together, given our overlapping, but not always, but sometimes competing interests? You know, that question is as old as humans, because some of men and women's interests are common, obviously. But in some ways, our interests and our inclinations kind of aren't. They overlap a lot, but in some ways they're slightly at odds with one another. And people have been negotiating that in different ways for as long as there have been humans, I think.
Okay.
But what we call feminism is just the latest iteration in that argument, and it's specifically what the form that argument takes in modernity, under industrial civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certain things that change in social and economic terms. You know, suddenly you have this very sharp split between the domestic and the private, you know, within which, you know, roles which were actually very much, in a weird way, more egalitarian. Like in the 14th or 15th century, everybody worked. Women worked as much as men, you know, but work happened in the household. And people might have combined keeping an eye on children with doing artisan work and, you know, tending a small holding and making a bit of this and that to sell. And it wasn't that one partner went out to work and the other partner stayed at home and the roles were very starkly divided. That's really an artifact of, you know, a very particular way of organizing work, you know, in a manufacturing civilization.
Yes.
So actually, you know, what people, the tradwife subculture is just not very trad at all. It's not nearly trad enough. You know, I think a much better way of looking at tradwives will be going back to the 14th century, not the 1950s. And say, well, you know, can't we reorganize work altogether so that everybody works in productive households like they did in the 14th century? You know, where everybody works, but they're based, you know, where a couple will work together and juggle childcare together around working from a household unit. You know, why can't we do it like that?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, how you negotiate all of those questions about who does what work and what work is more valued becomes it will change texture and change complexion altogether. you know, and a lot of the feminist arguments about workplace mores potentially, you know, would potentially go away, but you'd end up with a whole load of new arguments about how men and women reconcile their interests.
Yeah, there's this New York Times article just the other day. I only saw the photo, but there was a photo of a woman and a man, and the man was at his desk on his computer, and the woman was taking care of the child. And the interpretation that saw of that was that they're both stuck at home, but the woman's still dealing with the child, and the man gets to do his job, kind of thing. Right. So I don't know the particulars of that relationship. I don't know the particulars of how they compromise that. But the overlaying so-called feminist interpretation is that the woman is labored with the less valuable work, which is merely taking care of the new human being, where the man gets to do the real work.
I find that an incredibly offensive take, personally. I mean, it's a very Clinton feminist take, but it's a really offensive take. I mean, how dare somebody say that it's degrading for women to look after their own children? When did it become a source of shame to love our children? I just think that's a completely bonkers idea.
I don't understand how you can not understand the value of that. Because it's a hidden value. That love, you can't monetize that.
No.
It's invisible.
Exactly.
It's meaning. Exactly. It's noise.
Yeah, it's meaning. It's noise, exactly. And you cannot monetize it, or at least... My God, people have tried over the last few decades.
Well, you can divvy up. This is the problem. If you start doing this, then you're going to have a terrible relationship. But you can say, well, here's how many hours I did this, and here's how many hours you did that, and then everything
becomes...
Yeah,
and your marriage will be fucked within 5 years.
And then you're fucked. You're totally fucked.
Yeah, your marriage will be over within 5 years. If you start scorekeeping like that, your marriage is in trouble, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, you know, you have to bring a spirit of generosity and a spirit of being all in. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But because what we think of as feminism has become very stuck in the signal paradigm rather than the noise paradigm. And I think we need to make the feminist case for noise, basically, you know, as having a value in its own right.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, I suppose I just, you know, in flippant moments, I call my politics a reactionary ecofeminism. But it is, because, you know, it connects what I'm talking. Making the case for noise is also making the case for the natural world. And for a more respectful and relational encounter with the natural world, you know, which is mostly made of noise, not signal.
Yeah.
And trying to find our place within that and a relationship to that, and trying to find our place within a family or a social unit and our relation to that. And all of that, you know, it has to come from much more of a place of humility rather than mastery. And I don't see a beneficial role for a feminism which is committed to handing mastery to women, even in equal proportion to men, you know, let alone kind of over and above men. I don't take a position on, you know, which of those is actually taking place at the moment. I think, you know, trying to hand mastery to everybody rather than teaching everybody to be a little bit more humble, you know, just doesn't feel like a good and healthy thing to be doing right now.
If that speaks to a lot of different problems with a lot of different political paradigms that are working out, where people are seeking empowerment rather than seeking service, like that.
Yeah.
If the value was how can I serve my community, if that was promoted in a family relationship, in the neighborhood, et cetera, instead of what am I owed?
Exactly.
What is my right? My right is housing. My right is water. My rights are this, that, and other thing, rather than that responsibility and that servitude. But that speaks to, I can see a lot of people being very wary of promoting that. If you promote in your, let's say, feminism, that we're promoting a feminism of service, and we're asking men to serve us, and we're going to serve men, which I guess is kind of the seed of that trad thing. There's some form, my husband serves me, I serve him, and everybody's in this relationship of service rather than this other paradigm. It makes you weak. If you say, I want to be the servant, you are seen as weak, unless you understand that you're reversing the whole thing.
Something which I find myself thinking about in the context of this, you know, once you start from the premise that, you know, in fact we don't own ourselves, and we don't belong to ourselves, we belong to each other, and, you know, we have a degree of choice about which others we belong to, but not absolute choice. I mean, even your friends choose you as much as you choose them, and, you know, I have incredibly annoying friends who I love to bits, but there was a point where I just accepted that they were just going to be in my life, And the fact that I found them annoying was neither here nor there, because I still love them. there are people that just choose you, and there are relationships that just choose you. And, yeah. And that there comes a point where you just have to say, okay, this is the foundation. This is just the shape my life is. And I'm all right with that. But once you start thinking about, politics in a relational way like that, you don't have to go very far along that line of reasoning before you realize that you will soon need to be making a case for ethical hierarchies, or an ethical reappraisal of hierarchy. If we all belong to ourselves and we're all the same, then we can try and abolish hierarchies. But if we all belong to each other, you know, just like in the animal world, there are some animals which are bigger than others. If we all belong to one another, we will find that some people are more suited to a leadership role than others, for example. Some people are more suited to different kinds of activity. And if we, you know, and that could be fine if we all had a relationship of mutual responsibility to one another. I mean, everybody accepts, for example, that a 4-year-old in a family sometimes needs to do as she's told. the anecdote the story that makes me smile is, my little daughter, my little girl sitting there on the bath mat with not a stitch on, having decided that she doesn't want to get in the bath. And she said to me, "I don't want to get in the bath." And I said, "Well, you're getting in the bath." And she said, "You can't make me." And I said, "Well, I can actually." And I picked her up and I put her in the bath. And that's in a very gentle way, that's my prerogative as her mother, and that's completely appropriate. I mean, I know that there are some very radical egalitarian parents who wouldn't have done that. Yes. Who might have sort of spent an hour negotiating instead. I don't think that's a good way to live with your child. Yeah. I think there's a role for authority, and there's a role for just accepting that there are natural hierarchies. And this is not to say that might makes right. I'm not a Schmittian. I don't think that it follows from this that a social order in which pure power is the only justifier of who decides. But just to flip that on its head for a moment, I think a political order in which pure power is the only thing which decides what does or doesn't go is kind of what we have at the moment, and that's kind of what we're ending up with through the pursuit of egalitarianism. So perhaps I'm being a little bit perverse, but I do wonder whether if we just made a little bit more space for mutually respectful and mutually interdependent hierarchies in the way we organize our lives, we mightn't actually end up with a more holistic and more egalitarian, in the sense of mutually respectful, way of ordering things. I don't know, but I do wonder.
Yeah, there's a, on one level, you brought up the relationship between you and your daughter, and then that leads me to a probably a misconception. There's this, in the trad realm, there's a Christian, banding about some Christian sayings about the husband leads, or the wife is subservient to the husband, and it imposes a hierarchical relationship between the husband and the wife. And there's a proper way to do that, and there's an improper way to do that. There's the improper way would be to say that women belong in the kitchen, which is not what you're saying. That's going too far, but there is this... if we can evaluate the personality in every given relationship between who's better suited to what, and still, I guess, maintain the value of, let's just say, domestic labor or rearing the child, and make an honorable space to how important that is, and beyond just being paid or unpaid, I'm trying to fish around for how you establish ethical hierarchies, or how do you define that in such a way where it allows for people to be independent and forestalls corruption that is inherent in every hierarchy. But there's going to be corruption whether you like it or not in every given system.
I'm enough of a pessimist to think that the fallen nature of man, etc., there's always going to be a measure of corruption. You can devise the most perfect system in the world, and people have got up to some pretty hideous stuff in the 20th century trying to devise perfect systems. which would forestall possibilities of corruption, and it somehow the corruption always creeps back in. So I'm fairly accepting of, you know, you can't avoid a measure of that. You can't avoid a measure of that. You know, that, and that's not to say that it should be just welcomed or shrugged off or ignored. Yes. But at least if you're coming from a place that says, you know, this is a heuristic rather than a set of inviolable rules, you know, yeah, then we have a better chance of applying these understandings in a flexible way, which is appropriate to the context, rather than just, you know, as a set of precepts handed down from on high, which are applied without regard to the individual human.
Yeah.
And I suppose I don't know that you can do any better than that, really.
Yeah. So realistic, Mary Harrington. So grounded in reality.
I don't know about that. Yeah, so lost in internet rabbit holes most of the time, to be completely honest.
I absolutely adore your writing and your mind, and I have to get going. I hope I can have you on again, because it feels like we just kind of touched on a bunch of things that I would like to explore.
Yeah, we started about 10 conversations. Yeah, definitely. I would love that.
Yeah, if you don't mind, if you enjoyed this enough to want to.
Yeah, that's great.
Do you have any, what are you up to next? What's on your plate next? You write once a week. I will link your articles. Is there any other big project going on?
What am I up to? I've got a couple of slightly more political things in the works, but just in the works. So there's nothing really concrete to say about that. You know, possibly a book project, but that's all again subject to discussions. You know, another 10 book projects that I want to do after that. I'm going to write a version of the feminism against progress argument at some point in the next few months. I have a commission to do at least a chunk of that argument, which I'm really looking forward to, because I've been wanting to do a deep dive into why conservatives have a problem with women for a long time. You know, why do people say it's impossible to be a conservative and a feminist? And, you know, what genuinely is so repulsive about conservatism to women? Because it's a thing, it's real. And I think a lot of those women who marched against Donald Trump in their pink hats in 2016, only to discover that biological sex has just been abolished by the guy who was supposed to be saving them from Donald Trump, are really very lost at the moment, because they're like, now where do we go? Just fuck you all. Where do we go now? And so I want to sort of dig into that a little bit. You know, there's a lot of politically homeless women out there. And, you know, why exactly is it that conservatism is so repulsive? I have some ideas about that, but I'll write it rather than trying to explain it.
Is it kind of a yellow brick road to the Emerald City of some form of conservatism, you think? You're going to give women inroads to a more... I don't know, whatever you mean by conservative.
No, I want to salvage women's political interests from both sides, to be honest.
What end, then? Is there a way to encapsulate the end of your feminism?
Well,
the telos.
I mean, learning to live together, I feel like, you know, the relations between the sexes are going down a very dark path at the moment. And again, you know, I have a kind of spectator position on that, because I'm married and have been for some time, and I'm very fortunate in that way. But, you know, a lot of my younger friends seem to be in quite a dark place in terms of, you know, the relationships between men and women, which seem to become it's like everything's becoming a very sort of zero-sum game, where one side has to win and the other side has to lose, and, you know, and the casualties on both sides are just mounting up in a way which makes me actually, and over the longer term, deeply concerned for the whole edifice of women's rights, because I see a reaction brewing which will be very, 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 very bad for women. And I have a daughter, so I have skin in the game. You know, my telos, very straightforwardly, is salvaging whatever I can of the positives of feminism, such that my daughter can enjoy them, because I can see a very realistic scenario in which none of it is left by the time she's an adult.
Could you give a concrete example of one way in which women's rights will be...
Well, I mean, you know, but biological sex is being rolled back even as we speak. You know, the sex segregated toilets, sex segregated prisons, sex segregated sports, you know, all of that was fought for by a whole class of women, and is now being rolled back by another class of feminists. You know, it's perfectly plausible that my daughter will grow up into a world where there is no women's sport, and there are no sex segregated public toilets. you know, perhaps that's no big deal. I don't know, but perhaps it would be a really big deal. You know, we have to trust that everybody's going to behave themselves in order for it not to be a big deal. You know, there are
and lots they of, totally will, because they'll be given whatever they want. They totally because won't take
what
advantage.
Could possibly go wrong, right? Exactly. What could possibly go wrong? But I have skin in the game.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course I want to salvage the best bits. You know, I don't really want to go back to a world where I have no legal standing in my own right and I'm basically the property of my father and my husband. You know, that yes. sounds pretty shit to me. You know, I quite like being a person. I think there are, you know, fixating on progress and fixating on, you know, always moving things forward and always there always being more to win is increasingly sort of moving the whole movement in a direction which benefits only a very small minority of women. You know, the ones who are really rich and can benefit and can enjoy all of the freedom, and they're leaning on all the other women.
You wrote that article about Clinton feminists. Brilliant article. I'm going to link that one first. That was what I wanted to originally speak to you about, because you said basically that the feminism that's active right now is dispossessing, just like so many of these political movements that are for the minorities from the left right now, or actually, you know, like defund the police. Who's being screwed over by that? Minority communities who are poor.
Yeah, it sounds like progress, but actually what it is class war.
Yeah.
You know, on so many fronts.
Yeah.
It's class war. I mean, defunding the police screws over people who live in poorer communities who can't afford private security. Clinton feminism, you know, it's great if you're rich enough to be able to subcontract all of your domestic work, but it's shit for the women who you pay to do all of your domestic work and then go home to do their own.
Yeah.
Or employ undocumented workers to do it for them, who then have to go home, who then leave their children in another country being looked after by their grandmothers. Right, the whole thing is a Ponzi scheme.
It's a pyramid.
Yeah, it's a pyramid
Amway.
Scheme. Yeah, exactly. It's a the whole thing is a pyramid scheme, and it's great if you're at the top of it. But yeah. But you know, and sure, subcontract all of your stuff. But you know, do you know? So call it what it is. Call it outsourcing. You know, don't say what you're doing is a moral movement for the advancement of half of the human population, because that's not what it is.
Yeah. Mary Harrington, you're awesome. I want to have you back on. I have to go. I will provide all the links to your material, and hopefully people get turned on to your rabid mind. I don't know if rabid is the right word, but just that's the first one that came to me.
Maybe. It's been fun, Benjamin. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
All right. You have a good night.
Enjoy this a lot. And you, take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Ciao. Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.